Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Wait, you're listening?
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
From
WNYC.
See?
Yep.
And NPR.
Smile. Could you introduce yourself?
Yeah, just say who you are.
My name is Paul Auster.
And what do you do?
What do? I sit here and talk to people like you.
No, he doesn't. Paul Auster is one of the most prolific writers we have.
I do the best I can.
But I went to see him because anytime you open a Paul Auster book, you notice that he is noticing that in the world, there are lots of strange repeats. He calls them rhymes.
Rhyming events.
What is a rhyming event?
Well, a rhyming event would be something, for example, the girlfriend I had when I was very young, college freshman, sophomores, had a piano in her apartment, and the F above middle C was broken. It was the only note that didn't work on the piano. That summer, we got together and we went out to Maine, way, way out in the wilds of Maine near Eastport, and we were walking through pretty much an abandoned town. And we walked into what looked like an old elk's lodge or moose lodge. And we walked up to the piano that was sitting in the room. And my girlfriend could play very well, and she tested out the piano. One key was broken, F above middle C. So that, to me, is a rhyming event.
Rhyming. The F's always break.
But, yeah.
I don't know.
If that doesn't impress you, and I'm going to give you another one. This is a true story, by the way, the one you're about to hear, and it's a whopper.
This is too weird.
Well, it is. The room, five pages in. During the war, M's father had hidden out from the Nazis for several months in a Paris chambre de bonne. Eventually, he managed to escape.
What's a chambre de bonne?
A maid's room. It's a small room on the top floor of a Paris apartment building. Chambre de bonne. Eventually, he managed to escape, made his way to America, and began a new life. Years passed, more than 20 years. M had been born, had grown up, and was now going off to study in Paris. Once there, he spent several difficult weeks looking for a place to live. Just when he was about to give up in despair, he found a small chambre de bonne. Immediately upon moving in, he wrote a letter to his father to tell him the good news. A week or so later, he received a reply. "Your address," wrote M's father. "That is the same building I hid out in during the war." He then went on to describe the details of the room. It turned out to be the same room his son had rented.
Wait a second. So the father flees the Nazis, stays in this room in Paris, leaves, 20 years go by. The son happens to be in Paris, needs a room.
He finds a little.
So you're saying it turns out,
the same
exact same room?
Yes, where his
dad. And this really happened.
It didn't happen to Paul. It happened to a friend of Paul's, yes.
Wow, that is weird.
Yeah.
And what do you make of that?
Well, I'm not sure what to make of it, except that it gives you a funny sense that sometimes in your life, when something happens and then weirdly it happens again, that maybe that's intentional or maybe...
Like the script has already been written somehow.
Whatever it is, the question is there such a thing as fate?
Scientifically speaking.
Yeah.
Well, that's our question for the hour.
Is there fate? If there is...
Can you know it?
Yep. And more importantly...
Can you control it?
Once you get a hint of what it might be.
Yeah.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
I'm Chad Abumrad. This is Radiolab.
And let's get on with it.
Yeah. Okay, so to get things started, since fate is our topic, let's just amend the word, shall we?
What do you mean?
Because fate is not a word a scientist would ever use.
No, they don't.
They'd get laughed out of their peer-reviewed parties. they use words like genetic predispositions, genes, basically.
Although there'd be another scientist in the room who'd say, well, it isn't really the genes, yeah, it's the environment.
Yeah. Then another guy would walk in and be like, no, it's nature.
Nurture.
Right. Really, this argument, on some level, when it's a very old argument, is about choice versus fate.
Hmm.
And that tension gets really fascinating when you talk about something like willpower.
Hmm.
And Candy, let me introduce you to a guy. Okay. His name's Walter. Yeah.
Walter Michel.
He's a psychologist.
At Columbia University in the psychology department.
So what's going to happen is...
He has done a remarkable study. So are we ready to go?
Yeah.
And the marshmallow study.
The marshmallow study.
At the start of the study, how did you come up with the idea?
Well, I had three little girls who at that time...
We're talking now late 60s.
...were going from being these sweet sometimes and yappy often, little creatures.
How old were they at that point?
Well, they ranged in age from 2 to 5. And what I was... what any parent immediately knows is that when kids start... going into the fourth year of life, a lot happens to them.
Like, he noticed that one of his daughters who had just hit 4, suddenly she could delay gratification.
Yeah.
Almost all of a sudden, if he told her, look, I know you want that, I don't know, pack of bubble gum, but don't whine, don't complain. When we get home, I'll give you something better. Suddenly, she could wait.
This was in the late 1960s, and there was almost no work on, quote, willpower or self-control or self-regulation. It just wasn't a topic.
So he thought he would jump in. Here's what he did. To test this hypothesis that something happens to kids around the age of 4, he went to a nursery school.
Bing Nursery School at Stanford University.
Gathered up a bunch of kids of different ages, and one by one... he put them in a room.
A small room off the playroom.
He'd bring the kids in, sit them in a chair, and then he would give them a choice, which had to do with marshmallows.
Yummy.
What kid doesn't love marshmallows? And he would say to them, here's your choice. You can either have
one marshmallow
now, or if you wait, you can have two.
Two marshmallows later. Now, that creates a lot of dilemmas.
Yeah, it does. Especially because, you know, the researchers would leave the room to give the kids a chance to think. And right there on the table, in front of the child, were the marshmallows. Calling them.
There are no distractions in the room. There are no pictures. There are no toys.
The child
no
left anything, to stare
okay? So it's basically it's an isolation chamber.
Pure agony.
I can show you a video of what they're doing, and you can see it.
Can we watch?
Sure. Let's turn it on.
And, he walked over to a TV and pulled up a video of the marshmallow experiment. And I must tell you, it is some of the greatest video ever shot, particularly because the round he showed us, the researchers had replaced the marshmallows with something even more enticing.
Oreo cookies.
Oreos.
So what you're seeing over here is a tortured-looking, adorable little girl wearing a blue sweatshirt.
About 5 years old. Pigtails.
Kind of sniffing at it.
She puts her face right up to the cookie. She's weighing, do I want this badly enough?
That's exactly what she's doing.
She picks up the cookie, puts it down.
Weighing and reevaluating her choice.
She knows she can have this one now, but if she waits, she can have more. But...
I've had it.
She gives in after just a few minutes. Okay, now we have a sort of a doughy-faced boy in a yellow t-shirt. Who's kicking because he's so antsy. This kid's strategy is not to confront the cookie directly, but to kick the table that holds the cookie. Kick it, kick it, kick
and
it.
And it's a very male response.
But remarkably, he holds out. Way longer than the first girl. And of course, there were the cheaters.
Here we see a guy looking at the two cookies.
He's taken one,
which is against the rules. He's licking the inside. He's licking out the cream. Replacing the licked cookie and putting it back on the tray.
Anyhow, we watch kid after kid after kid being tortured by the gravitational pull of Oreo cookies. Some, to avoid the pull, went under the table. Some turned their backs and started singing a song. All in all, Michel and his team tested 500 kids in that initial study, and they found that yes, 4-year-olds are dramatically better than younger kids at resisting temptation. So something does happen at around 4 years old. But within that, and here's where the plot thickens, there was a huge range. Some kids gave up after a minute. Others could last 20 minutes. And most fell somewhere in the middle, where they could resist the cookie for about...
7 minutes, 8 minutes.
That's the average.
all depending on age and what the goodies are and so on.
Now, in and of itself, there's nothing too surprising here. He basically confirmed his hypothesis. But what is amazing, truly amazing, is what happens next.
I just was sitting around the kitchen table with my kids about 5-6 years after the studies began.
And he was talking with his kids, and he knew that they still went to school, this is now 5 or 6 years later, with some of those kids from the initial study. So he's asking them,
you know, how is Jenny doing? And how's, you know, how's Cecily doing? This was just totally informal.
And his kids told him, well, Cecily's doing fine. Jenny, not so good. And he began to realize a weird pattern. The kids, like Cecily, who he remembered had been good at waiting for the marshmallow back in the study, well, they
seemed to be the ones who were doing better.
They were doing better at school.
And suddenly, on a very small N, you know, very small sample, it looked like there were differences here. Could there be a relationship between the number of seconds these kids waited when they were 4 and how they're doing when they're 10 and 11 and 12? So what we did, beginning when these kids were 15 years old, 14 to 17 years old, was the first follow-up wave.
So he tracked down as many of those original kids as he could find, and just for starters, he looked at their SAT scores. Now keep in mind, this is 10 years later in some stupid little test that a kid takes when they're 4 that has to do with resisting a marshmallow and how many seconds they can resist should not, I repeat, not have anything to do with how they do on their SAT scores, which is one of the most important tests they're ever going to take. But
we found remarkable correlations between the actual SAT scores and seconds of delay time.
In other words, the kids who waited the longest when they were 4, staring at the Oreos, did better on the SATs than
yes.
The kids who just gave up immediately?
Yes.
How much better?
Significantly.
The differences are so big.
That's Jonah Lehrer, science writer, often a guest on the show, who's also reporting about these follow-up studies.
You know, the difference between a kid who can wait 1 minute for the marshmallow and a kid who can wait 20 minutes, the difference in the SAT scores is 210 points.
No way.
Yeah, this isn't, you know, fiddling at the margins. This is a profound difference.
Well above what one would expect by chance.
And as they dug into the data, it turned out it went way beyond SATs. The kids who waited back when they were 4, now in their late teens,
parents reported they were better behaved.
And on the flip side, the kids who hadn't been able to wait back in that initial study, they were more likely now to be suspended from school, to be classified as problem kids, to be, you know, the kind of kids who
were most likely to wind up as the bullies.
The results were so odd and strong that Mitchell and his team decided to keep following those kids up through their teens into their 20s and 30s and beyond.
So this is now roughly 40 years because they're about 44, 45 at this point. We're still in touch with over 250.
And they've expanded the kind of data that they're keeping track of. Everything from
How well they're able to stick to goals at work, how far they go in school.
Even their health.
For example, body mass index.
A huge amount of data. They really want to, like, amass an FBI file, so to speak.
And the more data they collect, the worse it gets. The kids who could wait back when they were 4, now in their 40s, have better jobs. They've gone farther in their education. They're even skinnier.
Yeah, yeah.
Than the kids who couldn't wait. Now think about this. How much willpower you exhibit as a 4-year-old in something so insignificant as trying to resist the pull of a marshmallow could predict this frightening amount about your life?
There's no question that there was something predictive about it and that it wasn't a fluke.
Here's what I'm wondering.
Yeah.
If I have a 4-year-old and I informally give them this test and they fail,
yeah.
Should I be worried? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know me, I've got such a bias against these kind of rigid predictive variables when it comes to the brain.
Yeah.
But I think these experiments have to give you pause.
Because one interpretation of Mitchell's work, and it's one we unfortunately cannot rule out, is that maybe self-control is hardwired. You either have it by the age of 4, or you don't. And if you don't have it, statistically, you're screwed. There's another way to interpret this, thankfully. If willpower gets its start when you're 4, which is a big if, but let's just assume for the moment it does, then you gotta ask, What exactly happens at age four that separates the willful from the rest of us?
So what you're seeing over here is a tortured-looking, adorable little girl.
Walter Mischel would say, go back to those videos and really look at them. If you do, much of what you'll see has very little to do with nature.
She's looking at it, she's withdrawing from it, and she's holding her breath.
The first thing you notice, he says, is that every kid is in agony, even the good kids. They are not models of strength. They are suffering, too, because Oreo cookies, man, they're good. Second, the very simple difference between the good kids and the bad kids seems to be that the good kids just found ways to distract themselves. They had strategies.
She's holding her breath.
Like this girl.
She's saying shh to herself and stopping herself.
Shushing. That seemed to work. Or?
Kicking it.
Kicking the table. That's actually a good strategy, he says. Or making up a tune.
You know, kids composing new songs.
Or just turning around in the chair.
Okay, we're back to girl number one now. She has her back completely turned to the cookies.
Some kids actually pretended the marshmallow was a cloud.
I mean, the kinds of things one sees are extraordinary.
Or the cookie was a UFO. They turned this hot stimulus into, as Mischel puts it, a cold stimulus.
And that might be all that separated the kids who could wait from the kids who caved.
The best kids simply had a better bag of tricks.
And if that's all we're talking about, tricks, well, you can teach a trick.
You know, I think one of my favorite twists on his experiment that he did was he found that you could take kids who had trouble delaying gratification, so kids who had really had a tough time waiting for the marshmallow, and you simply say to them, put a picture frame around the marshmallow, pretend it's a picture and not a delicious piece of candy. All of a sudden, you gave kids this little trick, and you could turn low delayers into much higher delayers.
Oh, so he could help these kids.
Absolutely. You can teach, just that simple suggestion, why don't you just pretend it's a picture frame? He's got these bar graphs, and it's dramatic. All of a sudden, the low delayers are performing just like the high delayers.
Really? And is there any evidence that if you teach these kids these low delayers and you give them these tools, that you can send their life in the right direction in some way?
There's no evidence of that yet. You know, he hasn't shown that simply teaching kids how to draw a picture frame around a marshmallow leads to a ballooning SAT scores. And that's where I think even Mischel admits that it remains unclear how valuable these tricks are. Because you can teach, obviously, a kid a trick to deal with a marshmallow in a lab setting, but that doesn't mean they'll necessarily be able to go home and you know, you can't go around drawing picture frames all day long.
But that's kind of the crux of it, no? I mean, you kind of have to know that these tricks are useful.
Yeah.
Otherwise, you're just picking your interpretation. You could say, oh, it's learned tricks or it's hardwired.
Yeah. So I think the answer to that remains completely unknown. They're just beginning to fly all these subjects out, you know, it's a couple days worth of brain scans. I mean, this is a big, big project. No one quite knows what they'll find.
I mean, I think it's highly likely to be like most things in life are turning out to be, which is, yes, the wiring makes a difference, and yes, the experience makes a difference, and the wiring and the experience are interacting and changing each other.
So, Jad, I, who have never been able to withhold my fierce desire to eat all the chicken when seven pieces of chicken are served to three people, I will eat four pieces of chicken. Mm-hmm. And yet somehow I have gone through most of my life holding a job.
Doing quite well.
So, you know, I think before people take Mr. Mischel's views too close to heart, remember there are outliers. There are people who have grabbed the marshmallow early and yet who have somehow thrived.
We'll be right back.
Hi, this is Paul Oster. Radiolab is funded in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation.
This is Walter Mischel. Radiolab is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR.
Radiolab is supported by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, exercising, cleaning. What if you could also be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com, Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Radiolab is supported by Betterment. Let's talk about hustle culture. You know, the whole rise and grind, go big or go home thing. It's a lifestyle that may not be for you, but one that your money can handle thanks to Betterment. Betterment is the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. How? How? Their automated technology optimizes your investments again and again. With Betterment, your money is taking ice baths at 5 a.m. while you get your well-deserved rest. Your money downs protein smoothies and automatically reinvests your dividends, all before you head out the door. Your money is a workaholic, but you don't have to be, because you've got Betterment, the automated investing and savings app that makes your money hustle. Visit Betterment.com to get started. Investing involves risk. Performance is not guaranteed. Hey, Lulu here. You asked, and we listened. You wanted a Zuzve shirt, and we made one. It is a gorgeous celebration of the liminal being that is Venus's moon / not moon. And you yourself can sport this homage to the unknowable multitudes of those all around you and within you by simply joining The Lab. The Lab is our membership program that is the place where we fight the fight against the fickle whims of the economy to make our show protected from all that based on listener support. If you sign up, we thank you with the brand new Zuzve t-shirt and also ad-free episodes, bonus interviews, and other swaggy stuff like stickers and patches. You can go check out the perks and see if it's right for you by going to radiolab.org/join. And thank you, either way, for being here, for listening to our show. We make it for you, Zve. Anyway, radiolab.org/join. Check it out. And thanks.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radio Lab.
Subject is
fate. And
so after the marshmallow story, I was thinking, you know how people, when they hear a thing like that, that your child will be successful through life if it
you can know it at age four.
Right. This is actually how people behave. They try to figure out in their children, well, where are the deficits? Where are the advantages? How can we
as early as possible?
And, yes. And they project out from the four-year-old straight to college.
Yeah.
And there are some people in this world who find this obnoxious. And one of them is Malcolm Gladwell, who grew up in Toronto.
Okay, just pull it to your mouth there.
It's Canada, so they don't do any of this sort of thing. He's the author of Outliers. And at the 92nd Street Y, he told me how much he hates gifted and talented programs.
It's ridiculous. Why do you decide? So a gifted program says that we identify a child and call that child gifted because of their performance at the age of whatever, 9 or 10 or 11 years old. Why do we care particularly how well a child performs at 9 or 10 or 11 years old? They're 9 or 10 or 11. They're a good 25 years from making any kind of substantial contribution to the world. Why don't we wait? What's the hurry? And also, how do you know? So, like, you know, so one child learns to read at 4. One child learns to read at 2.5, right? So what? Why does it matter? Are the things that are being read between 2.5 and 4 of such incalculable?
No. Like it's the normal parent's response to, oh, if he's reading at 2.5, think of the things he'll do, and it's just an extrapolation.
I know, but like reading is reading. Once you can read, we're done. I mean, it's not like there's an infinite scale, and that so and so reads better and better and better. And we can say today of Gladwell that he reads so much better than Krulwich, and that this is like what separates the two of us. It's reading. I mean, like.
Well, but now the effect, for example, on, like, you use the phrase the Matthew effect. What is that?
Matthew effect is a phrase coined by Robert K. Merton, the great genius sociologist of Columbia. He's the guy who says in the verse in Matthew, which says that to him who has much more will be given. And he uses this to describe the Matthew effect, which is this notion that a small initial advantage, difference in the performance of any two people will inevitably grow because the person who's a little bit ahead will get so many more advantages that they will end up being far ahead. So a good example, there's all kinds of great Matthew effects. So if you're a young boy born in October, November, or December, who has designs on being a professional soccer or hockey player, the deck is stacked against you. There's not much you can do. You should probably give up.
But there's a way to fix this.
Well, it's really an accident of birth thing. The month you were born in, Malcolm thinks, might make a huge, huge difference in your life. Here's his way of describing this. I'm going to read here a passage from his book, Outliers.
On page 23 of your book, you do a play-by-play.
Kind of a clever way to do this.
Uh-huh. We're at the Memorial Cup Hockey Championship. I want to read what you wrote. March 11th starts around one side of the Tigers' net, leaving the puck for his teammate January 4th. He passes it to January 22, flips it back to March 12th, who shoots point-blank at the Tigers' goalie. April 27th, blocks the shot, rebounded by Vancouver's March 6th. He shoots Medicine Hat defenseman February 9th and February 14th dive to block the puck. January 10th looks on helplessly. March 6th scores. Question is, why did you choose this peculiar kind of nomenclature?
Because I wanted to make this point that an extraordinary number of hockey players are born in the first 3 or 4 months of the year.
17 of the 25 players on the Medicine Hat team were born in those first 3 months.
Yeah.
Why?
Yeah. Because the eligibility cutoff date for age class hockey in Canada, in the world, is January 1st. And we start recruiting all-star squads in hockey in Canada when kids are 9 and 10 years old. But, of course, when you're 9 years old, the best one is the oldest one, right? So all you do is you choose the kids who are born closest to the cutoff date, and then you give them special coaching and put them on all-star squads until 9 and extra games and extra practice, until 8 and 9 years later, they really are the best. And, by the way, we see exactly the same effects in school systems. Right, the relatively youngest kids in the class underperform the relatively oldest kids, and that underperformance lasts into the college years. The kid born the last 3 months of the youngest 3 months of their age cohort in school are something like, I forget the exact number, 9 or 10% less likely to go to college than those born in the three oldest months.
And but Chad, I agree that, when you're born matters, of course.
Yeah.
But I kept saying to him, well, what about natural talent? What about if you really were a great hockey player?
Just popped out with it.
And then he said, well, it's really practice, ability plus practice, emphasis on practice. I said, no. What about the idea of just being a genius? He has this problem.
You were being accused of being a genius denier.
Yes.
Are you a genius denier, or are you simply a genius disliker?
There's clearly this thing called talent, right?
Right.
It's the magic dust, right, that gets sprinkled onto persistence that turns a lot of hard work into something great. And the question is, how large a role does it play, and what does it consist of? I mean, there's a piece I wrote years ago for The New Yorker. I remember writing about Wayne Gretzky and reading a biography of Wayne Gretzky, and he's a
great hockey player.
Great hockey player. Greatest hockey player of all time. And as a kid, when he's 2 years old, his parents would sit him in front of the television, and he would watch hockey games on Saturday nights. And when the game ended, he would burst into tears, right? And it was this little glimpse into his future greatness, because here he was at two, and he loved this thing. He couldn't even play hockey. He's two. I mean, he can barely walk. But he already has understood he loves this thing so much that for it to end is an unconscionable burden, right? And it's like the world is ending, and he's disconsolate. So what is Wayne Gretzky's talent? Well, part of it is his extraordinary, vision, his coordination, his whatever is this. But a lot of it is this guy loves this game so much that he would do nothing but do it and think about it and engage it and do all those things. Now, is this magic dust called talent, is that all it is? Maybe. Why are people so hostile to the notion that what genius is an extraordinary love for a particular thing? Why is the love... We hear the ability definition of genius, the rare ability definition, and we think, oh, that's so plausible. Totally, that's what it is. But then we hear the extraordinary love definition of genius, and we say, he's a genius denier. Why? Why are we so hostile to the notion that what separates the genius from the rest of us is the genius loves what he or she does more than we do? But we have no problem at all that what separates the genius is that they have some, you know...
It misses the point. I mean, there are people like Paul McCartney...
Are you hostile to the notion of love, Robert? Is that what that is?
I just want to make an obvious point here that, you know, Harry Smith... No, that's a real person. Harry X could love writing songs, but Paul McCartney
could
love...
Even the way you say love, though, is so... Really, have you thought about this?
I'll do it differently. Your Harry X could love...
Uh-huh.
Love.
That's better.
Writing songs.
Uh-huh.
He loves writing songs so much that he can't stop, but for lunch and dinner and sometimes not even those. But next door is Richard Rodgers, Ricky Rodgers.
Mm-hmm.
He loves writing songs too. But for some reason, Harry writes and loves writing. Ricky writes and loves writing. And Harry writes an unmemorable song called The Babbling Brook Goes To and Fro. And Richard writes Some Enchanted Evening.
Well, no. So you're...
So there's a difference there.
No, well, but hold on.
The love doesn't get you...
No. The love does. So think about this. Love is not the complete explanation. Love is the way in. Because Wayne Gretzky loves hockey so much, he thinks about it all the time and does more than that. He engages the sport in a way that no one else has ever engaged it. So there's this wonderful, when I was writing about Gretzky, there's this thing that he famously did once where he scored a goal from behind the net. And he flips the puck over the net, and it kind of does a little thing and goes in. The reason no one had ever done that before was not just that no one could do it. Lots of people could do it. It had never occurred to anyone else before, right? No one had engaged the sport on that level. So why is Gretzky engaging in that way? Why is he thinking about it that deeply and creatively? Because he can't get hockey out of his head, right? Mm. Whenever I encounter someone like that, I cannot get past that sense they give off that they have found their calling, that they are actively in love, in almost a romantic way with this thing that they do.
No, you're right.
Absent that, you can't be a genius. I'm sorry, you can't. Are you convinced yet? Are you still holding out for some chilly, abstract, you know, Nietzschean notion of...
No, I'm going to pull back for a minute here and try another tack altogether.
Well, let me just to
I got a little shy there at the moment.
Yeah, but to give you credit, my Nietzschean co-host.
Thank you.
You know, there are people who try, love what they're trying to do deeply, and yet fail. Over and over.
But that's because they don't have the talent. That's what I was arguing. They don't have the talent to do it.
No,
so
but I'm
not
thinking
gonna...
of a whole other category of being who just seem doomed.
To failure?
Endless failure.
Like?
Well, Walters, you wanted to just play this from the beginning?
Yeah. Just one second here.
This is our producer, Pat Walters.
You live in Arkansas, is that right?
That's correct. Yeah, yeah.
I don't think you have roadrunners down there, do you?
No, they're roadrunners. I think they've maybe gotten into the far western part of the state.
You know what that is, Jed?
I hate that freaking bird.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a roadrunner. And who is this dude?
This is Mike Barrier.
I'm the author of a book called Hollywood Cartoons, American Animation in Its Golden Age.
He's basically the guy you call if you have a big, profound question about Looney Tunes.
Looney Tunes.
Yeah. A few months ago, Lulu and I started wondering,
Lulu Miller, our former producer.
Why is Roadrunner so good? Because I'm at least in the camp.
That's your question?
Yeah. But before we get to the answer, I just want to give you a little background on the cartoon.
All right. Go for it.
It's 1949, and you're at the movies with your wife. You go in and you take a seat, and when the movie starts, one of the very first things you see is a cartoon. And in the 40s and 50s, most of these cartoons were
chase cartoons, Tom and Jerry being the prime example.
Problem was, this chase thing was a formula. It was rigid, and it got a lot of cartoonists kind of bored.
Yeah.
So one day, this kind of famous cartoonist named Chuck Jones, sitting around with his buddy Mike Maltese,
just talking about what oddball combinations of characters that could be chasing each other. I think Maltese thought about having an aardvark chasing a gnu or something like that.
What's
something
a gnu? I don't even know what a gnu is. But just to cut to the chase, eventually they decided, let's make a cartoon about
a coyote chasing a roadrunner.
And when this cartoon came out, it was huge. It was a hit.
What does it mean for a cartoon to be a hit?
Like in those days, cartoons usually only ran one time.
Huh.
But this one was different.
6 months after it came out, they started making another one.
Which was almost completely unheard of. Which brings us back to Lulu's question.
Why is Roadrunner so good? Because I'm at least in the camp that it's way better than Tom and Jerry.
And Mike says it's actually all about
the coyote. He's an extraordinarily human animal.
And not just like in the facial expressions that he made and the ways that he looked at the camera a lot.
Yeah.
But actually, it kind of was about the predicaments that he found himself in.
Meaning?
Take, for example, this one really famous cartoon. Like always, Coyote has got a plan. He has made a painting of the road.
Showing the road continuing over a chasm.
Like he's put this painting right at the edge of the cliff.
The idea being the Roadrunner would run through the painting, gravity would take hold of him, and he would plunge into the chasm.
Roadrunner comes flying down the highway, and he gets the painting. But he doesn't fall.
Instead, the Roadrunner runs into the painting as if it were the road were actually continuing. But then when the coyote tries to follow the Roadrunner into the painting, he runs through the painting and falls.
And he looks up at the camera and he shrugs and he's like, why did the bird get to run into the painting and not me?
Gravity isn't this uniform, indifferent force. Mm. It's a malignant force that actually that comes in and out of play according to how inconvenient it can be for the coyote.
But that's interesting. The Roadrunner isn't his real opponent at all. It's the universe.
Right. Oh, yeah. No, he's chasing the Roadrunner, but the universe is his opponent. Absolutely.
And that's kind of what makes the coyote seem so human. He's in that situation that all of us feel like we're in sometimes. Like the very laws of physics are against us.
Yeah, it's almost a primitive way of thinking, but I think all of us lapsed into this, you know, that how can this happen?
Right, the universe is out to get me.
Like. Yeah, you can't be human and not feel that way.
On the other hand, even though the universe is screwing you, at least it's noticing you.
It's kind of flattering in a way.
It's totally flattering, yeah. And this, Mike says, is why the cartoon works. Like on the one hand, it confirms our paranoias, and on the other, it kind of plays to our vanity.
Flattering. Is that really? I mean, when you said flattering a second ago, is that really what it is?
You don't see it that way?
I don't know. I've never liked this cartoon because he never wins. It's like, what's more flattering, to live in a world that actively screws you at every turn or one that just doesn't care about you? Like a Nietzschean void.
I don't really know. That's kind of tough.
I go with the void.
No!
What do you mean
totally
no?
Totally ignored by the universe?
Yes!
That's the worst.
As opposed to being actively screwed by the universe? Yeah, sure, ignore me.
You don't know. What you don't know. Let me tell you the story. I went to ABC News and I did a story that went very well. And then the next week I did a story which went very badly. And the head of the place, Rune Arledge, called me into his office. And this was Rune Arledge, a legend in broadcasting. And then he put his face right in front of my face, his nose almost touching my nose, and said to me, I hated this, I hated that, what's wrong with you? And instead of being sad and upset inside my head like Wile E. Coyote himself, I thought, wow, he knows my name. He watched my story.
But if Rune Arledge had said that to you every single day.
Well, he didn't do it every single day.
I know, but in cartoon form, that's essentially what's happening here.
Yes, but
the universe
cartoon
is yelling
but
at him.
But the reason saying, I like Wile E. Coyote is because I admire the guy. He has no evidence at all that anything good will ever happen to him, and yet he wakes up every day with hope.
Meep, meep. Hope schmope. He's just a masochist.
Thank you. Pat and Lulu. Thank you to Pat and Lulu.
See ya! We'll be right back.
This is Casey calling from Fort Myers Beach, Florida. Radiolab is supported in part by the National Science Foundation and by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world. More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Radiolab is supported by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy. Radiolab is supported by Babbel. Sometimes self-improvement can feel like a pretty overwhelming journey. So what if this year you just got a tiny bit better every day? When you're learning a new language with Babbel, that's exactly what you're doing. Babbel is a science-backed language learning app with quick 10-minute lessons that have been handcrafted by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. You can learn everything you need to have real-world conversations, café s'il vous plaît, from vocabulary words to culture and more. And if Babbel can help you start speaking a new language in just 3 weeks, imagine what you could do in a few months or a full year. Here is a special limited-time deal for Radiolab listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners at babbel.com/radiolab. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/radiolab, spelled BABBEL.com/radiolab. Rules and restrictions may apply.
Hey, I'm Chad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab. Today,
subject is
fate.
So, if you think there is such a thing as fate, and you want some hint of what is the plan for you, what's in store for you or for someone you love,
what is predestined for
yes,
you?
Yes. Then, well, as we know, our professor at Columbia, Walter Mischel, he would simply offer you a marshmallow.
Yeah.
Malcolm would ask you what your birthday is.
Yeah, but there's another way to do this.
What?
Just look at what a person writes, their emails, their essays, whatever. What if you were to take that text?
Hello.
Give it to this guy. He puts it into a computer and you turn it into
data.
What do you mean? Who is that?
My name is Ian Lancashire. I'm a professor of English at the University of Toronto.
Now, Ian, as he said, is an English professor, but he's also a computer guy.
Right. Founded a computing center with the help of IBM Canada.
And the reason he combines those two is because he's interested in the secrets behind the author's words.
Mm.
And that desire, he says, to take a text, spin it into data as a way to get into that author's head, well, that goes back a long way.
It goes back to the fathers of the Christian church.
The Bible.
In the early Middle Ages.
So monks decided to make what's called a concordance of the Bible. And what that means is they were going to take every single word in the Bible, and there are 960,243 of them, at least in the King James Version, and they were going to list them all alphabetically, notate each time every single word was used, and the context.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yes, imagine it. You begin with the first verse.
In the beginning.
You create a heading for the first word.
In.
And then for the second word.
The.
And then for the third.
Beginning.
Every time you come across those words, you have to write a context.
In Genesis 1, verse 1, occurrence 1, in the beginning. Genesis 1, verse 6, occurrence 2, and God said, let there be firmament in the midst.
It's all handwritten. And at the end, you end up with a lot of pieces of paper.
So many that it took those first monks, you know, who decided to do this, an entire lifetime to complete it. Nowadays, you know, with computers, you can be done in
under 15 seconds.
Bam! So that all just basically sets the stage for the story that I'm about to tell you. It's the 1980s. Ian is an English professor at Toronto. He's got a lab full of computers, and he's using them to analyze his favorite authors.
Samuel Taylor Coleridge, T.S. Eliot, James Joyce, Cadman, Chaucer, Shakespeare.
And he's turning up some interesting stuff. Sort of.
For example, in his poetry, Milton didn't use the word because. Who knows why?
Yeah. But at a certain point, Ian decided to look at more modern authors.
And so I turned to Agatha Christie.
At the time he was doing this, we're now in the 90s, Agatha Christie happened to be the most published author ever.
She sold a billion books.
A billion? Like B billion?
She was number one.
Behind God.
After the Bible, I think. So what I did is I collected two of her earliest novels, written in the early 20s.
He fed those two into the computer.
Then I did the third.
Eventually, he would add in 14 additional books that cover 50 years of Agatha Christie's writing. What is the computer doing exactly?
Measuring the individual concordance, word frequency, the vocabulary of the works.
And all the while, it's spitting out these reports.
And I saw the totals at the bottom.
So all this. Now, first of all, the woman wrote 80 detective novels, which is just amazing in and of itself. The computer found that her use of language was relatively consistent and normal for the first 72 of those books. But something happened on book number 73. Something drastic.
What?
Suddenly, her use of words like...
Words like thing, anything, something, nothing.
What Ian calls indefinite words.
These words increased 6 times.
But also, when the computer added up the vocabulary size of that book...
That is, how many different words are there in the first 50,000 words of a text?
It found in this book, there were 20% fewer different words.
That is astounding. That's 1/5 of our vocabulary lost.
It gradually dawned on him that what he might be seeing was the very beginning stages of an author... losing herself.
She had developed Alzheimer's. I delayed publishing my results for 2 years. I had to have the results analyzed by a computational linguist and a statistician.
And in her lifetime, was she ever actually diagnosed?
Absolutely not. There was no diagnosis.
He said that some of her biographers suspected that something was up in her later years.
At one point, apparently, she cut off all her hair. She was not doing very well in interviews.
But as far as we know, she was never taken to a doctor, never got diagnosed.
I think her family closed around her and protected her. I realized that I was seeing something about the human mind. I was seeing the author in the text in a way that people hadn't seen the author in the text before.
Which raised a question for me, and I think this can apply to anyone. I mean, we all write a bazillion emails a day. I've got a decade's worth on my computer. Does that stuff hold clues about what will be? Like early warning signs?
I think it's possible it does, yes, and it's well worth doing research about how a loss of vocabulary can be determined, let's say, in one's email over 5 or 6 years.
Indications are, he says, that those clues are there. Not only that, they may actually be there practically from the beginning.
Oh, yep.
A very famous example is the so-called Nunn study.
Okay, the Nunn study actually began in 1990.
This is Dr. Kelvin Lim. He works at the University of Minnesota and is the current director of the so-called Nunn study. And this study, more than any other that we know, really makes the point about the predictive power of the words we choose. The study began with a guy named David Snowden who wanted to look at aging over time. So he chose nuns because he wanted a group that was healthy.
For example, they don't smoke. They don't drink.
They all have similar lifestyles.
They obviously haven't had children.
So he approached this one particular order in Connecticut.
Called the School Sisters of Notre Dame.
And he signed up just short of 700 nuns. And the only stipulation being...
You had to be at least 75 years of age. And so we're now 20 years into the study, so that means the youngest of the sisters is about 95.
Yeah, I think I am. I am the youngest.
And you are 94 years old.
Yes, sir.
Not 95.
Not 95.
This is Sister Alberta Sheridan.
I like the way you said that.
Do you happen to know who the oldest remaining sister in the study is?
Wait a minute. No, the one who was buried today, Jan, was 101. I think she was the oldest one in the study.
Wow.
In our province, yes.
The study began, innocently enough, she says. The researchers would show up to the convent every year, give the nuns a bunch of tests.
Like mostly for memory, just questioning back and forth.
And then over the years, as the nuns passed away, which many of them have at this point.
They've all gone, Jed.
Of the original 678 sisters?
At this point, we have approximately 40 sisters still alive and participating in the study.
And I'm the only one left here in the Wilton province.
And as the nuns would pass away, the researchers had arranged it so that they would get a small piece of their brains.
Yes.
Which they could examine for plaques and tangles.
Now, this morning we buried a sister here, I told you. But the funeral was delayed a bit because she had to be taken to the hospital to have a portion of her brain removed to further the study.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so here's why I bring this study up. Because of an accident that happened pretty early on that changed everything in the study. David Snowden, the main dude, was in the convent archives, and he was talking to the archivist. The archivist says to him, hey, you know all of these nuns that you're studying who right now are over the age of 75? I actually have the essays that they wrote right when they got here.
And they did this roughly at about age 18.
Like 60 years before?
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah.
Right.
I have a copy of it at home. Oh, that's great. Come on in, Naomi.
Thank you so much.
We actually asked a reporter, Naomi Starobin, to visit Sister Alberta at her home in Connecticut.
Are you late today?
And have her read her essay that is now 76 years old.
Yeah, go ahead.
2 days after the birth of the Christ child, I was brought as a belated Christmas gift to a Mr. and Mrs. Albert Joseph Sheridan of Providence, Rhode Island. A week later, the sparkling waters of baptism were poured over me. I'm not going to read all the silly stuff that when I first entered.
Why not?
It sounds kind of saccharine. I was only a teenager when I wrote.
But here's the thing. When the researchers found the essays like the one you just heard, it was a gold mine.
It was a major, major find.
So they analyzed the essays looking primarily at
two specific features of the language that was contained in these narratives.
That's Sergei Pahoma. He does the analysis for the current nun study.
In particular, they looked at the notion of grammatical complexity and idea density.
What is idea density? What does that mean?
Idea density is a measure that looks at how many basic units of meaning are contained in any given utterance, divided by the total number of words in that utterance.
In other words,
the date of my birth is December 27th.
Like if you were to listen to Sister Alberta's autobiography.
When I was 11 years of age, my dear mother was called to God.
It's the number of little discrete ideas she's able to cram into one sentence.
This was to be a turning point in my life, as I had always had the ardent desire to become a sister.
Here's a classic example of the difference between low and high idea density. Here's low.
From Sister Helen, I was born in Eau Claire, Wisconsin on May 24th, 1913, and was baptized in St. James Church.
Okay, that's low. Now here's high.
From Sister Emma, it was about a half hour before midnight between February 28th and 29th of the leap year 1912, when I began to live and to die as the third child of my mother, whose maiden name is Hilda Hoffman, and my father, Otto Schmidt.
I gotta say, I'm liking the first one.
Jed, probably you as a journalist, see the first one as straight to the point.
Yeah, it's good writing.
And the second one seems kind of embellished.
A little bit, yeah. But here's the punchline of all this. Turns out that the people who, when they were 18, wrote in that journalistically very precise, low idea density sort of way, those people, 60 years later, were vastly, vastly more likely to develop dementia. In fact, based on those essays alone, the researchers could predict, with about 85% accuracy, what the nuns' brains would look like when they died and were able to look at the brains. I mean, would the brains have plaques and tangles that you associate with Alzheimer's, or would they not? What?
I mean, that's just crazy.
Wait, why?
It's backwards reasoning. Well, we'll see. We'll see. I'm suspicious. Here's
why?
A man who, from what you just said, has found the ones who got sick and working backwards, found certain incidences of this, that, or the other, and says, ah, this is a cause that produces this effect.
No. There's no cause and effect here.
These studies are demonstrating associations, right? They're not demonstrating causality.
Right?
It's a very important distinction.
This is just a correlation, okay?
But, you know, that may be one of 190 correlations that produce people who get Alzheimer's in the end.
Yeah, I mean, but let me argue your case actually from a different angle. Like, would this kind of linguistic analysis actually be relevant
In the age of Twitter, where everything is short and clipped.
But people who Twitter don't only Twitter. They might also write small, short, dense essays for their...
Yeah, but, well, you know, I mean, I guess you are right. It's like, it's mostly about the thoughts in your head, not so much what you write.
Well, so what about Agatha Christie? Was there a conclusion about Agatha?
Yeah, there was.
Agatha Christie writing Elephants Can Remember.
This brings us back to Ian Lancaster and that 73rd book of Agatha Christie's that he analyzed and found that her vocabulary dipped. Well, before he did the analysis, he picked up that book and gave it a read. And like most people who read it, didn't like it.
Initially, I thought it was very poorly written, badly plotted, full of errors of time, of dating. Terrible read. Then I realized when I looked at the title, Elephants Can Remember.
He realized that maybe Agatha Christie sensed what was happening to her.
She was responding to that truism that elephants never forget. Hmm. The chief character is an aging female novelist named Ariadne, who is a foil for Agatha herself. And she, Ariadne, is suffering from memory loss.
In the story, she tries to help a detective solve this crime. But she has trouble. She keeps forgetting.
And the last sentence in that novel, in fact, is Agatha saying, well, maybe it's okay not to remember.
Wow.
She was trying to defend herself, defend her sense that she was forgetting. She was losing her vocabulary. She was losing her language. I began to see that Christie was heroic, still writing despite this handicap.
Yeah.
And her willingness to do that at an age of 81, 82 struck me as heroic in a way.
Well, I understand that. That's... The muse wouldn't quit, but the tools all left the room.
Yeah.
So thinking about Agatha Christie and the nuns, and then earlier in the marshmallows, and basically to pull this show all into a nice happy knot, there are two ways to think about destiny. First, you can think, well, I have one. There's some kind of pattern in my life, some sort of...
All you have to do is look at the clues, and I can maybe know what it is.
Or the other view is, who knows? Que sera, sera. What will be, like stuff happens.
Anything can happen at any time.
That's Paul Auster. Remember him from the beginning of the show?
Yeah.
And he's, curiously, in this show, he's the guy who says, there's no pattern, no way, no how.
You're on your way to your wedding and you die in a car crash. I mean, these things happen. So, listen, talking about the true stories that I've written, I mean, the really crucial one is the thing that happened to me when I was 14 years old, when I was out on a... hiking with a bunch of camp kids in the summer of 1961, and we got caught in a lightning storm, and we were going into a clearing. But in order to get to the clearing, we had to crawl under a barbed wire fence. The lightning and thunder are crashing all around us. And the boy right next to me was struck by lightning and killed. And he was as far away from me as you are from me right now. Really? We were right next to each other. Let me just... I might as well. Okay. I don't remember saying anything. I don't remember crying. Another boy and I kept ourselves busy trying to take care of Ralph, the name of the boy. He was still unconscious. We rubbed his hands and arms. We held down his tongue so he wouldn't swallow it. We told him to hang in there. After a while, his skin began to take on a bluish tinge. His body seemed colder to my touch. But in spite of the mounting evidence, it never once occurred to me that he wasn't going to come around. I was only 14 years old, after all. And what did I know? I'd never seen a dead person before. Later on, when they told me he was dead, I learned that there was an 8-inch burn across his back. I remember trying to absorb this news and telling myself that life would never feel the same to me again. Strangely enough, I didn't think about how I had been right next to him when it happened. I didn't think one or 2 seconds later and it would have been me. What I thought about was holding his tongue and looking down at his teeth. His mouth had been set in a slight grimace, and with his lips partly open, I had spent an hour looking down at the tips of his teeth. 34 years later, I still remember them. His half-closed, half-open eyes, I remember those too. And I can't tell you how this jolted me. It absolutely formed, I think, my whole view of life. The thing that I said before, anything can happen at any moment. When you think about how many people there are in the world, how many things there are, how many cars in motion, how many buses moving, planes flying. Well, sure, things are going to intersect in different ways, and we can't predict how.
So that's what we're examining. And I thought, well, maybe you would agree that there is some kind of string through the world, which if you know how to push it, will tell
you. You see, I really believe firmly that stories can only be told backward. You can't predict.
So the notion which we're suggesting in the other stories is that you begin your life, you walk into the world, you write down an essay, you don't or do eat a cupcake. And these people in the white coats look at your essay and look at your cupcake reaction, and they go,
Well,
and they say things about you going forward, way forward in time.
I don't know. These seem like random variables to me. There are about 10,000 other things that probably factor in. So too many.
But you'd make a terrible social scientist.
Yeah, I know. Well, I remember Charles Olson, the great American poet, he called sociology a withered grape. And I think I tend to agree with him.
I guess you got us right. Radiolab, making wine out of withered grapes.
That should be our tagline.
Paul Auster's most recent book is called
Invisible.
Yeah, that's right. Very hard to find. And the story we just heard comes from his book, Invention of Solitude.
That's right. And we got to go. But we're always online at radiolab.org. Subscribe to our podcast there.
And thank you for listening.
Yes. I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Kerwood.
Bye.
Radiolab is produced by Jad Abumrad and Soren Wheeler.
Our staff includes Ellen Horn, Pat Walters, Tim Howard, Lynn Levy, Lulu Miller, and Brenna Farrell.
With help from Raymond Tungikar, Sam Rudman, and Nicole Khoury.
Special thanks to Naomi Sarolden and Katie Sowell. Talk to you later. Bye.